We have been studying the life of David, and we have been in just journeying along with his life for several weeks. In fact, 11. This is the 11th week that we have been studying David. And today we're going to study one of the most intriguing dramas, I believe, in our Old Testament. It's in the 25th chapter of 1 Samuel, and there we have the biblical version of Beauty and the Beast. And as we read this together, I'll let you figure out who the beauty is, and you figure out who the beast is. As we study through David's life, we have in between this hunt by Saul to kill David, sandwiched in between chapter 24 and chapter 26, where Saul is hunting him, we have this little story. And we're going to call this a play. It's a very insightful, it has a lot to say to you and a lot to say to me about how we should handle difficult situations. Now, before the curtain rises up on our play, let's just meet the three that we're going to study today. So in chapter 25, beginning in the first verse, we read these words. Now, Samuel, the prophet, died. And all Israel assembled and mourned for him, and they buried him at his home in Ramah. Then David moved down into the desert of Maon. A certain man in Maon who had property there at Carmel was very wealthy. He had 1,000 goats and 3,000 sheep, which he was shearing in Carmel. His name was Nabal, and his wife's name was Abigail. She was an intelligent and beautiful woman, but her husband, a Calebite, was surly and mean in his dealings. So there are two leading men and our leading lady. And as this drama unfolds, I believe that you're going to find yourself identifying with one of them, maybe at times all of them. These people reflect what's good and what's bad in all of us. So our play opens, and the first scene is in the desert. And as the curtain rises, it is payday in the land of Carmel. The text says in verse 4, while David was in the desert, he heard that Nabal was shearing sheep. Now the desert of Maon is tough country. And the only reason that David and his men are out there is because that is the kind of country that is convenient for fleeing from pursuers. So they're out in this tough wilderness country running away from Saul. But not only were they running away from Saul, but since Saul had given up his chase of David for a while, as we saw in the last chapter, they kind of became the unofficial patrolmen of the neighborhood. As they wandered through the countryside of Maon, they voluntarily guarded the flocks of the people who lived there. Now, I'm not just assuming that. You're going to read later in this chapter in verse 16 that Abigail was told that they were like a wall of protection around the flocks and herds all the time that they were out there. So, while they are out there in this tough country where there are thieves and there are robbers, the shepherds did not have to worry because David and his men were out there and they were like this big hedge of protection. Now, it was customary during holiday seasons, as we'll read in a moment, that this was a very festive time. The sheep shearing time was a holiday time. During festive seasons in their culture, it was very customary to say thank you to people who have been kind to you by giving them a gift. We do that at our holidays. Well, you don't have to, but you might give your mailman a gift around Christmas. Why? I don't know most of the time, but maybe just because of his faithful service every day to you and your family. Now, think about going into a restaurant to sit down for a meal and you give a tip to your waiter or your waitress. Now, there's no rule that says you have to be kind and you have to leave a tip, but it is expected and it's very customary. And it's even more so, I believe, around the holidays. And there's not a law that says you've got to leave a tip. You can leave the restaurant without doing that, but it's our custom to do that. But this is a time, because David and his men have been kind, and because it is the custom to help those who were kind, this was a time that they expected a return of some kind from Nabal. After all, David and his army of 600 men out in the desert, it's hard enough to feed 600 men when you are in paradise, but when you are out in this kind of country and you're a fugitive out there, it's hard to come up with food. So David would have been very grateful if Nabal would have shown kindness for what his men had done throughout the past year. Let's continue reading in verse 5. Our text says this. So he sent 10 young men and said to them, "Go up to Nabal at Carmel and greet him in my name. Say to him, 'Long life to you, good health to you and your household, and good health to all that is yours. Now I hear that it is sheep shearing time. When your shepherds were with us, we did not mistreat them, and the whole time they were at Carmel, nothing of theirs was missing.'" You see, back in this day and age, it was the custom, if you're out in the desert and a flock of 3,000 sheep comes by and you are starving, well, it wouldn't hurt too much just to take one. And that's kind of how things happened back then. There were no pastures set aside or you know, fences that put animals in. They just had them out roaming in the area. And David said, "Not as much as one of your sheep went missing the entire time that we were with you. We didn't take them, and we didn't let anybody else take them either." So our text goes on, verse 8. "Ask your own servants, and they will tell you. Therefore, be favorable toward my young men, since we come at a festive time. Please give your servants and your son David whatever you can find for them." Now, he's not trying to blackmail Nabal. He's not saying, "If you don't give us something, we're going to start taking your sheep." He's not even asking for a particular amount. He's not saying, "You know, the way I figure it is 1,000 hours of sheep watching means you owe me this much." This is a festive time. It's the holidays. He's just saying, "You know, it would really be nice if you would give to these young men a token of your gratitude for what we have done for you." Well, scene 2 takes place at the ranch of Nabal. Read with me, picking up in verse 9. "When David's men arrived, they gave Nabal this message in David's name. Then they waited. Nabal answered David's servants, 'Who is this David? Who is this son of Jesse? Many servants are breaking away from their masters these days. Why should I take my bread and water and the meat I have slaughtered for my shearers and give it to men coming from who knows where?'" In other words, Nabal said, "I don't recognize any leader of a band of runaway slaves. There's no official army out in the desert of Israel. Just a bunch of runaway slaves. I hear a lot of slaves are running away from their masters these days." Well, what is he doing? He's not just refusing to give David a tip, but he is implying that David is a traitor and he is not a legitimate leader of Israel. Saul is. Now notice again, remember how we talked a couple weeks back about this people group that was out in the desert called the Ziphites, and they were going to Saul to try to help Saul catch David. Well, the Ziphites were of the tribe of Judah. That's the tribe that David was from. Now, it says that Nabal was a Calebite. What tribe was Caleb from? The tribe of Judah. You see, in the early days of David's life, it was his own people who gave him the most problems. His own kinsmen were the ones who were refusing to recognize his leadership. And so Nabal, one of his own brothers of the tribe of Judah, says, "You're not a leader. You're a traitor. You're a runaway slave. You're a leader of runaway slaves. I have nothing to offer to you." Well, scene 3, we're back in the desert. And you need to understand that there is a principle that is at play here that is very important to remember, and that is You never know what a hungry man is going to do. Males of the species can be very logical and rational until they get hungry. A lot of men need this t-shirt. Now, David was hungry. And when his men came back, he was ready for some supper to come back with them. But look at what happens. Verse 12, it says, David's men turned around and went back. And when they arrived, they reported every word. David said to his men, "Put on your swords." So they put on their swords. David put on his. About 400 men went up with David, while 200 stayed with the supplies. You know, I thought when I read that, imagine not leaving a tip at a restaurant. You're going out to your car and the waitress comes out with a sword ready to hack you down. You see, David is overreacting here just a bit. In the first place, why do you need 400 men to go with you after one guy who didn't give you a tip? That's kind of like trying to kill a cockroach with a shotgun. Which, by the way, I totally understand. I hate cockroaches. But it is overkill. It will get the job done, but it's way overboard. And one reason why I like to study David so much is that he was a man of incredible extremes. I mean, we saw last week, Saul was in the cave with David, and David showed incredible restraint and grace even when he had this awesome opportunity to take Saul's life, and he didn't. In fact, he said, "I won't touch the Lord's anointed." And a couple days later, here comes this old sheep farmer, and he's saying, "I don't have a tip for you." And David says, "Put on your swords. Let's go wipe him out." Does that seem a little bit like a contradiction? Same man. One day he shows marvelous restraint for refusing to kill Saul, and now an insult makes him fly into a rage. Why is that? It wasn't so much the food. The real issue here is that Nabal has hurt David's ego. It stung David when Nabal said, "I don't listen to runaway slaves." And David thought to himself, "You know, I'll take a lot off of King Saul, but I'm not going to take anything off of that old sheep farmer." So he passed the big test, and he failed the little test. Isn't that like you and me? I mean, aren't we pretty good about passing the really big test and letting the little teeny things make us go absolutely crazy? So it says in verse 21, David had just said, "It's been useless. All my watching over this fellow's property in the desert so that none of his was missing. He's paid me back evil for good. May God deal with David, be it ever so severely, if by morning I leave alive one male of all who belong to him." Now, this is a good example of the poor judgment that you will make when you try to make a decision while you are angry. David got hot under the collar because Nabal wouldn't give him any fig cakes. Next thing he says, "I'm going to wipe out every male in that man's household." Aren't you overreacting, David? I mean, it's just one man who insulted you. Look at this proverb. Proverbs 26, verse 4 says, "Do not answer a fool according to his folly, or you will be like him yourself." You see, the irony of chapter 25 is that David is looking as foolish as Nabal. Now, it's not his anger that is the sin. The sin is the way that he wants to express his anger. And our act one closes with David and his men riding off toward a massacre. Now, act two. For the first time, our heroine shows up. Look at verse 14 in the text. "One of the servants told Nabal's wife Abigail, 'David sent messengers from the desert to give our master his greetings, but he hurled insults at them. Yet these men were very good to us. They did not mistreat us, and the whole time we were out in the fields near them, nothing was missing. Night and day, they were a wall around us all the time we were herding sheep near them. Now think it over and see what you can do, because disaster is hanging over our master and his whole household. He is such a wicked man that no one can talk to him. Now, evidently, his servants had tried to go to Nabal and say, "Master, that was a foolhardy thing you did. Those men were good to us, and now you've put all of us in jeopardy." But nobody could talk to him. And by the way, if you are in a position where there are people that are under you, I hope that you never treat them in such a way that they would talk about you like that. I hope that under you, when there are people beneath you in your position, whether it be at your job or whether it be on some committee that you are on, that people would never say about you, "You know, you can't even talk to him when he gets angry." Well, let's pause a moment and think about Abigail. When she was a young girl, her mom and dad decided that it was time to find her a husband. She was to be pledged to a man, and she might have been as young as 8 years old at the time, and they looked around, and who's the richest man in the desert? It was Nabal. He has 3,000 sheep. He has 1,000 goats. He's got a good heritage. He's from the line of Caleb, the most respected family in the tribe of Judah. He has a big ranch, and they thought to themselves, you know, our daughter could not do better than to be married to a man like that. He is the most successful man in the countryside. And she was a pretty girl. She showed intelligence beyond her years. And so it was arranged. And Abigail grew up knowing that she would be pledged to marry Nabal. And all of the other women were jealous of Abigail. She had the nicest clothes. She lived in the nicest tents. Everybody wanted to be invited to Abigail's party at sheep shearing time because it was the best one. But do you know something? That lady's life was miserable. She was trapped in a marriage she did not make, nor did she necessarily want. And now's her chance. Now is her chance to get out. When that servant came and said, "If you don't do something, I promise before the sun comes up tomorrow, you're going to be a widow." And she could have thought to herself, "Great." She could have said, "That fool made his own bed, let him lie in it." She could have sounded a lot more spiritual and said, "You know, you're right. We better pray over this." But this noble woman impresses me because she remembered that even with all of his faults, she stood before the Lord and entered into a covenant before the Lord with Nabal. He was her husband. With all of his faults, he was the one that she had pledged to be faithful to before the Lord. So she organized a buffet for 400 people. Read with me, verse 18. Abigail lost no time. She took 200 loaves of bread, 2 skins of wine, 5 dressed sheep, 5 seahs of roasted grain, 100 cakes of raisin, and 200 cakes of pressed figs. And she loaded them on donkeys. And then she told her servants, "Go on ahead, I'll follow you." But she did not tell her husband Nabal. Notice how she is acting in his favor without his knowledge. Why didn't she tell Nabal? Because he was so foolish, he would have told her not to go. By the way, women are not doormats. Submission in a marriage does not mean under a man's thumb or under a man's foot. The Bible says this woman was intelligent. She was a godly woman, and she did what was needed for her family in this moment. And anyone who doesn't think that women cannot make great speeches has not read their Bible. Because Abigail gives one of the greatest speeches in the Old Testament. Act 2, scene 2, she's in a valley, she's coming up one road, and David and his men are coming down the other way, and she heads them off at the pass before they can get to Nabal's ranch. And look what she does. Verse 24, it says this. She fell at David's feet and said, "My Lord, let the blame be on me alone. Please let your servant speak to you. Hear what your servant has to say. May my Lord pay no attention to that wicked man Nabal. He is just like his name. His name is Fool, and folly goes with him. But as for me, your servant, I did not see the men my master sent." First thing that she does is say, "David, consider the source." Nabal's name in Hebrew really did mean fool. And she said, "Why do you think he has that name?" And what she is subtly doing is suggesting to David that maybe he should reconsider exactly with whom he is angry. Should David have plans to wipe out a whole family of men because of one fool? That took courage to say to David. But read on with me. Look at verse 26. "Now, since the Lord has kept you, my master, from bloodshed and from avenging yourself with your own hands, as surely as the Lord lives and as you live, may your enemies and all who intend to harm my master be like Nabal. And let this gift which your servant has brought to my master be given to the men who follow you. Please forgive your servant's offense. For the Lord will certainly make a lasting dynasty for my master because he fights the Lord's battles. Let no wrongdoing be found in you as long as you live. Even though someone is pursuing you to take your life, the life of my master will be bound securely in the bundle of the living by the Lord your God. But the lives of your enemies he will hurl away as from the pocket of a sling. When the Lord has done for my master every good thing he promised concerning him and has appointed him leader over Israel, my master will not have on his conscience the staggering burden of needless bloodshed or of having avenged himself. When the Lord has brought my master success, remember your servant." Wow, that's powerful. To translate this into simple language, what she is doing is she is saying, "David, the next king of Israel ought to have more on his mind than the slight of an old sheep herder. You ought to be thinking about how you're going to run the country, not how to deal with an insult." She subtly challenged his spiritual reasoning. She said, "David, God can take care of your enemies. He can take care of your enemies like a stone being thrown from a sling," which is no doubt a reference to the battle with Goliath. "David, all you used to need was your faith in God. With one stone, you could take out a giant. And now you have 400 men to go after one sheep herder? That's not how you used to make decisions, David. You are putting your future in jeopardy. You will have the staggering burden of needless bloodshed on you if you act like this. Think about your past, David. Think about your future, David. You could subtitle this story, A Cool Hand on a Hot Head." Look at how David responds to this woman. David said to Abigail, "Praise be to the Lord, the God of Israel, who has sent you today to meet me. May you be blessed for your good judgment and for keeping me from bloodshed this day and from avenging myself with my own hands. Otherwise, as surely as the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, who has kept me from harming you, if you had not come quickly to meet me, not one male belonging to Nabal would have been left alive by daybreak." David saw God's hand on her mission. Now here's something about David that really impresses me. Up until this point, David has been acting very foolish. But this is the difference between David, a man after God's own heart, and so many other people in the Bible. He could admit that he made a mistake, and he showed the courage to correct it. So right in front of all of the men that he had made this foolish vow, David retracts it. And he said, "You know, I'm not going to do what I said I was going to do. She has helped me with her good judgment to see that was a foolish vow. Have you ever pledged yourself that you were going to do something and then the next thing you know it's time to do it and you wish you hadn't said it, but you didn't have the courage to tell the people around you that you're not going to do it now? If Darius, King Darius, had shown that kind of courage when all the people said, "You signed this edict, king. You need to throw him in the lion's den." You see, the Bible says Darius did not want to do that to Daniel. But he did. Because he didn't have the courage to say, "You know, that was a dumb law. I'm going to change it." What if Herod had that kind of courage? The Bible says he didn't want to behead John the Baptist. But he was afraid because he had made this vow to the daughter of the wife that he should not have, that he would give her whatever she wanted. And she asked for John's head, and it says because all the people that were there that heard him say this, he didn't have the courage to say, "Well, I'm sorry, honey, but you can have anything but that." You see, our commitment to do what is right cannot be influenced by our company. It has to be influenced by what is right, no matter what. And if someone with good judgment helps us to see what is right, then we have to change our minds, even if it's embarrassing to do so. Well, our play closes fairly quickly, and here's where the romance comes in the third act. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, Nabal has sheared all of his sheep and he's made a bunch of money, and he's so happy about all of the money that he has made, he decides to throw a party for himself, and he has such a good time at his own party, he gets drunk celebrating his own success. So here's Abigail. She has saved his worthless skin, and instead of coming home to appreciation, she comes home to inebriation. Sometimes, honestly, those things just come out perfectly for me. I don't even know how. Nabal would not have been celebrating, though, if he could have heard the whirl of God's sling. God was about to let a stone fly. Let's read verse 36. When Abigail went to Nabal, he was in the house holding a banquet like that of a king. He was in high spirits and very drunk. So she told him nothing until daybreak. Then in the morning, when Nabal was sober, his wife told him all these things, and his heart failed him, and he became like a stone. About 10 days later, the Lord struck Nabal, and he died. I have had the difficult task more than once of being called by a family member of a person with no connection to a church who has lived an utterly godless and even wicked life, and they have become suddenly very ill. And you never know exactly how to deal with something like that. I mean, is Satan sending this man a thorn? Has God struck this man? And you never know exactly what to ask to the Lord. I was recently at our local area preachers meeting, and one of the guys was sharing a story about a church wanting to expand their property, so they were going around the neighborhood where their church was located, talking to the homeowners of these homes around the church's property, asking if they would be able to buy their home. And this one deacon approached this man who came to the door, and he said really spitefully to him, "I will die first before your church ever gets my property." A deacon came back to the preacher. He said, "You know, I don't even know how I'm supposed to pray for this guy." How do you pray for a Nabal? Well, let's look at what David said. He just cracks me up. Verse 39. When David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, "Praise be to the Lord, who has upheld my cause against Nabal for treating me with contempt. He has kept his servant from doing wrong and has brought Nabal's wrongdoing down on his own head." You know, David was honest before the Lord. He didn't go through all of this pious baloney and say, "Oh, what a shame." When someone said, "David, you know Nabal died?" He said, "Great, praise God." And then David got to thinking, "You know, that Abigail made some of the best fig cakes I have ever ate." Look at the latter part of verse 39. Then David sent word to Abigail, asking her to become his wife. His servants went to Carmel and said to Abigail, "David has sent us to take you to become his wife." That's the aggressive approach, fellas. But look at her response, verse 41. She bowed down with her face to the ground and said, "Here is your maidservant, ready to serve you and wash the feet of my master's servants." Guys, if you ever propose and you get an answer like that, do not let her get away. Here comes David's men saying, "David wants to take you for his wife." And she says, "I'm a maidservant ready to wash his feet." Do you know what Shannon said to me when I proposed? "Well, what's your net worth, buddy?" She didn't say that. You don't find Abigails too often in this life, so don't let them get away. Now, that's the end of our play. The curtain falls and everybody's happy. Righteousness, true love has prevailed. But do you know something? This story is not a fairy tale. It is a real story about real people. And it has some real application for you and I. So let's look this over. First, from Nabal, remember the importance of your character. Here's a man like Nabal, and the world says he's got everything. He has a good family name. He has a beautiful wife. He has an abundance of possessions. He's the kind of man that parents would say, "You know, I hope my daughter can marry a guy like Nabal." But the scriptures say that the Lord doesn't look at the things that man looks at, because man looks at outside stuff. But God looks at the heart. And Nabal's heart was so hard spiritually that the Lord just decided to make it hard physically. Now, I wonder if Nabal is who Jesus was thinking about in Luke chapter 12. Jesus said, "Let me tell you about a man, a rich fool. He had barns and grain and sheep and money, and he had so much, he had to build bigger barns. And he threw a party for himself. And he said, 'Let's eat and drink and be merry.' And that very night, the Lord said to him, 'You fool, this very night, your soul will be required of you. And what's going to happen to all of this stuff that you thought was so important?'" Sounds like Nabal to me. What God is looking for is not what you have, it's not who you marry, or how impressive your family heritage is. You know something? There are no grandchildren in God's kingdom. There are only children. Who your great-granddaddy was does not impress God. Who you are is important to God. There are only children in the kingdom of God. So, from Nabal, there's an important application. Remember the importance of your character, but from Abigail, remember the importance of your commitments. And there is so much about this lady that I would like to commend to you, actually more than we have time for, but I'm just going to pick this one thing, and hopefully it will stick with you. Her philosophy about difficult marriages is completely foreign to this culture. She did not view marriage as a contract. She viewed it as a covenant. And even if you are married to a worthless fool, you do what you can to save it. You do not look to get out of a marriage, even if it is bad. You do not find many ladies like that anymore. But she had made a commitment. And it wasn't just a commitment to Nabal. She had made a commitment to God that she would pledge herself to be faithful to that man regardless of how he acted. That's what marriage is. It's not a contract simply enforced by the law so that if your partner breaks the contract, then you can end the marriage. It is a covenant. It was designed by God. It is ordained by God. This covenant was made before God. And it is to be preserved and saved at all cost. That is why it is so important before you marry. to make sure that your potential mate has all of the right qualities. If he doesn't give two flips about spiritual matters before you are married, what makes you think all of a sudden he's going to become some spiritual giant after you are married? Now, Abigail came from a culture where she did not have a choice in the matter of who she married. You, however, do. So when you marry, you make a commitment to God to stay in that marriage. And in our culture, you have the freedom to choose the kind of person that you will make that commitment with. So choose well. Finally, from David, remember the importance of your calling. And this is for all of us. As Christians, we cannot afford to be sidetracked from God's purposes for our lives. I am a Christian. That makes me the most special thing on this earth. I am part of the most special body on this earth, His church. I have the most precious gift on this earth, His salvation. I have the most precious task on this earth, to share the gospel with people who need it. I cannot afford to be sidetracked by petty little things when I have a kingdom I need to be thinking about. But if you're like me, do you know when I forget my calling? It's not with the big things. When Saul is after me, I usually handle that pretty well. It's the little things of life that get me to forget my calling. I can handle some big criticism leveled against me in an email or maybe even on social media. In fact, that's happened to me many times. But I can go home and get into a knockdown, drag-out argument with my wife over where she put the remote. And God has called us to something more important than to be frustrated or angered over lost remotes or tips we think we should have received, or the slights that we all get in this life. Paul said, as was read at the beginning of our service, "As a prisoner for the Lord, then I urge you to live a life worthy of the calling you have received." Well, how do I do that, Paul? Next verse. "Be completely humble and gentle. Be patient, bearing with one another in love." How do I live a life worthy of my calling? I practice humility and gentleness and patience and love as I am bearing with people. That's how I live up to my calling. God doesn't give us patience, by the way, on credit. God gives patience day by day, sometimes moment by moment. And the first thing each day that you need to do is you need to get up and you need to say, "God, I need patience from you today. I need to be a gentle person. I need to be humble today. And I need your love. And I need to show love. So help me, God, today to be the person you want me to be." Start your day by remembering what He's called you to do. Why don't you stand up? I want to pray over you this morning. Father, speak to us this morning through your servant David. May we have the courage of David and the wisdom of Abigail and the good sense not to be impressed by the Nabals of this world. Help us, God, each day. And Lord, if there are troubled marriages here in this room, let us remember your covenant. Father, help us, Father, to do all that we can to fight and save that which we pledged to you we would do. I pray this, Lord, in Jesus' name.